From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump's weekend tweet aimed at four progressive first-term congresswomen are being widely denounced as nativist. Trump tweeted, "Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came?" But only one of the four is foreign-born, and she's joined by many other Congress members who were born elsewhere. We'll have the latest on the response after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you had a good weekend. Good to have you with us. Coming up later on a far lighter note than the one on which we begin, the demise of the Silver Lake podiatrist sign Happy Foot, Sad Foot. It gives us the occasion to celebrate our favorite unusual or beautiful business signs, either still turning or those that have gone through the years. But first, President Trump's tweets yesterday that are being widely condemned by Democratic elected officials and by some Republicans. The tweet reads, "So interesting to see progressive Democratic Congresswomen who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, most corrupt and inept anywhere in the world, now loudly and viciously telling the people of the United States, the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, how our government is to be run. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came? Then come back and show us how it is done. These places need your help badly. You can't leave fast enough. I'm sure that Nancy Pelosi would be very happy to quickly work out free travel arrangements." So that's the tweet by President Trump that was immediately and widely denounced. President Trump, just commenting on the steps of the White House, said, "If you're not happy here, then you can leave." And the president said a lot of people love what he had, love the country, but if you're not happy, if you're complaining all the time, very simply, you can leave. Again, Democrats have widely denounced. We have not heard as much criticism from Republicans to what the president has had to say. Joining us to talk about the very latest on this, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, and Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Sean, let me start with you, your response to what the president tweeted.
Well, I think the president knows exactly what he's doing, and he's playing out a bit of a strategy not entirely dissimilar from what Richard Nixon did back in the late 60s and early 70s. It's basically the theme of America, love it or leave it. And he's distilled this kind of sentiment down to a bumper sticker. And while there are, you know, Democrats in high dudgeon, there's a reason the Republicans are being quiet. They're being quiet because they know if they come out and attack President Trump on this issue, you know, having a nuanced discussion on this issue will fall by the wayside and they'll get criticized and attacked by members of their own party.
So Republicans can't come out and say this is wrong for the president to do it. This is essentially a nativist attack saying that if you don't like the United States, then, you know, you need to leave. These individuals were elected by their constituents to make changes to government, to represent those constituents. So how is this a defensible argument that even if they were foreign, even if all four were foreign born, how is this a defensible argument?
Well, I don't think it's a defensible argument. If I were advising members of Congress, I would specifically go out and say these remarks are, you know, deplorable. They're not the right thing to say. And then I would quickly pivot and I would go after members of the Democratic progressive wing of the party and say that their views are extremist. They're out of touch. They basically go against the heart of America's laws. And so with regards to people coming into the country illegally, with regards to other activists, you know, Medicare for all. So I would just criticize the president's comments. But then what I would do is I would actually go out and attack the Democrats' policies.
OK, just to clarify, you're not saying Medicare for all is against the law. You're talking about the immigration issues.
Yeah. So immigration issues and then but I would go after the Democratic electoral candidates' positions across the board. I would say that they're out of touch. They're socialist, bordering on communist. And I would go after them specifically on those policy debates. And those are good debates, I think, to have. But with regards to, you know, again, I would criticize President Trump for his intemperate words, but he is doing what he does. It's little Marco. It's, you know, crooked Hillary. It's Lion Ted. He's trying to distill down certain issues into bumper sticker issues that a certain segment of the population hears. And once they hear that, it's, you know, instant identification. So,
I was just going to. So, Matt, to me, what I don't understand, the first thing we were going to talk about on today's segment before this blew up was the infighting among Democrats, which we were going to continue the conversation we had Friday, because this is a big issue. So, and in fact, President Trump came to the defense of Nancy Pelosi in that conflict. Now we're talking about what I think is widely viewed as a nativist tweet by the president. Some call it racist, but I mean, clearly talking about if you don't like it, here go. How is this politically smart?
Well, for three of the women who are not, who are from here, I mean, the only one who's not from here is Ilhan Omar.
She came when she was 12.
And she came when she was 12. So, and was a refugee. So this, I was thinking a lot about this on the way in, because this is just, I can't think of anything that is more Donald Trump than this. And we can get to the outrage part of it, but that I think goes without saying. As far as the analytical part, I guess what I thought was already happening was the Democratic Party was putting itself in some jeopardy and some problematic positions. You already had, you know, what's happening at the debates, they're going very left in terms of immigration. That's going to potentially be a problem, especially on the open borders claim. I think healthcare is going to be a real concern if people are going to have their healthcare taken away. And then on the identity politics, as it relates to the Democratic Party, it has become something that's kind of encircling them, because at some point that type of political correctness doesn't tend to just stay in one place. It isn't just aimed at Republicans, as you notice. It was sweeping up Joe Biden. I mean, when you have Kamala Harris saying, you know, Joe, I don't think you're a racist. I mean, that, even just that comment. And then AOC and the Washington Post essentially saying Pelosi, for all intents and purposes, was going after women of color. So all of this was already happening to the Democrats anyway. So whatever strategic value Trump thinks he's doing by pushing it, it's already moving in that direction. And now we're talking once again about Trump's attitudes towards being president for all Americans. And again, like, I don't know what's going to happen in a year, year and a half when the election happens. But this is the type of thing that has moved suburban women away from him, that some of these urban areas. And this is going to make it more difficult simply because he's just so divisive and he's decided to completely run on this. And he's not going to have Hillary Clinton that he's running against in 2020, who was a similarly divisive figure.
Yeah, you had the two lowest ranking presidential candidates in popularity ever.
Yeah.
And the odds that that whoever the Democrats
is going to
be that unpopular, he's not going to have that advantage.
Is unlikely. And certainly if it's a Joe Biden, it won't be. And then, for a while, I always thought Elizabeth Warren was so far left, there's no chance of this. But now you start to watch this play out. And, you know, you do sometimes, and David Axelrod, who was Obama's advisor, talks about this. There's often a pendulum. And sometimes the fall of the president after the one before him or her tends to be sort of different of temperament. They're almost like opposite, polar opposites. And sometimes that will happen usually after 8 years as opposed to four. But 4 years of Trump feels like about 25 years, I think, in ordinance. It's like dog years. So I don't know how this is going to play out. We've seen this before and it tends to go away. So I don't want to overstate the moment, because we've seen this and we're on to something new. But this is another example strategically. And obviously, just you're the president of all the people, and insisting on behaving like this as the president is abhorrent as usual.
We keep hearing people talk as though, you know, there's some grand strategy that the president is employing. But Sean, to me, this seems so counterproductive to him when he had this gift of Democrats in open conflict, and now he's pushed that all to the back burner.
Well, whether you agree or not agree, I do think it's a little bit of a Nixonian-esque strategy. So I think the president knows exactly what he's doing. I think what he's trying to do is, by throwing these, you know, little firebombs into the Democratic constituency, he is trying to force the Democrats to go further left, to attack President Trump on a bigger basis. And then at some juncture, the left then divides and fights amongst itself. How far left do you go? Do you go to extremes with regards to people not in this country legally? So I think there's a real question here. In the next election cycle, will suburban Republican women come and support President Trump? They didn't come out and support Republicans well in the last election cycle, and it's why they lost the House. But I think the president is all in a poker game with all of his chips, saying that I'm going to divide the Democratic Party. I'm going to divide the left, and then I'm going to conquer. So,
well, this brings everybody on the left together, though, Sean.
Maybe yes, maybe no. So, you've seen infighting with the four members of the Congress when President Trump did, make his comments. We've heard a lot of criticism of Republicans for the last decade about the Tea Party, and they're divided, and there's all sorts of problems. And, to be honest with you, I don't think the media has covered very closely the real, real angry rift amongst a lot of Democrats, people wanting to see hardcore progressive activities, and those who want to play a little bit more to a conservative, moderate Democratic party. So I think Larry, he's got a method, and he's got to his madness, and I use that intentionally. So the question is, will it work? I don't know. It may.
Yeah, Matt?
No, I was just going to say, I hear what Sean's saying. My only bone of contention is more, do you think you're going to pick up suburban women by appealing to this part of their sort of worst angels of their nature? Or, it would be different if the economy weren't in great shape. You're talking about a president who is the economy is in remarkable shape. You have had you can actually make the case that the economy is not only better than it was under Obama, but that some of the lower income workers are actually doing better in terms of wages. There's a million ways to skin statistics, but they're actually doing reasonably well. And are you going to go after them with sort of a basic security message on immigration, talking about how good the economy is, keeping the status quo, which is, he in theory, if you look at the metrics, should be in pretty good shape for his reelection. So are you going after some of those voters that you have alienated over the course of time? Some of those women, some of those suburban voters, some of those moderates, are you going to win them back by this, trying to push the Democratic Party into the complete socialist arena, which they're already, and I think Sean is right, the Democrats are already having their own kind of low-level civil war that I think is going to probably continue to increase as we get into the fall? Or are you going to just try to sit there and say, like, look, what's the part you don't like? The piece of the prosperity, right? The world's going, we're not in any kind of crazy wars right now. Yeah, I say intemperate stuff, but we're doing okay. The economy's doing pretty well. I'm here for law and order. And so I just do questions. Are you going to bring some of those voters back into the fold by this type of thing? And that's the thing, at least what we've seen historically, has actually push them away from him because of their dislike of his general attitude around these types of issues.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has written a letter to her fellow members of Congress saying that she will bring up a resolution condemning President Trump's, quote, xenophobic tweets. It says our caucus will continue to forcefully respond to these disgusting attacks. It's not clear about the timing of the vote. Sean, is that going to put any pressure on Republican House members to vote for a condemnation resolution?
I think it does. It is uncomfortable. And again, with regards to President Trump, there are a number of Republicans who actually like the policy goals and objectives that are being brought forward from his administration that mostly has gone subservice because he puts out these incendiary tweets on a fairly regular basis. People aren't paying as close attention to what's happening in the departments and agencies across the country. But if you're a Republican, of course you don't want to be out there, throwing bombs in with President Trump on some of his incendiary comments. You just kind of wish that he would just hit them back on certain issues that they think are leftist, socialist, communist, and then have that policy debate. And they feel they do well with that, particularly in the central part of the country and out in the far west. But with regards to no one's going to, I think, come on board and pat President Trump on the back. And some of them may come out and make some, comments saying, well, there are some real issues here, but we wish you would say it differently. So I think that's probably what you'll get the most out of Republicans.
All right. We're talking with our guests on Air Talk who join us regularly on Mondays. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Sean Walsh, Republican analyst. President Trump just responding to the heavy criticism he received for his tweet of yesterday, defending his comments, saying people essentially, if they don't like being in the United States, should go back you can leave. He said, if you hate our country, you can leave. This in response to criticism of his tweet over the weekend. Condemnation vote, Sean, I assume that's like a censure, something like that. Is Do you know what that is?
I would assume some kind of censure. There's a few different, you know, there could be a sense of the Congress, something along
different
those lines.
Levels
there's different levels
criticism.
They could run to. Censure used tends to be pretty formal, but there's something they can probably do.
All right. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll continue our conversation on politics, the 2020 presidential election, as we're getting closer to the debates next week. Give a chance again for the field of around 20 of the candidates to take their case to the public. We'll be back with more on Air Talk in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Good to have you with us every Monday. We bring together political analysts from a different perspective, share their thoughts with us. Today it's Matt Rodriguez, a Democrat, and Sean Walsh, Republican, to talk about the big news that's come out of the White House. Of course, the 2020 presidential race continues to heat up as well. President Trump had said that major immigration action was going to occur yesterday, but it was actually fairly low-key. New York Times reporting that ICE arrests of individuals and deportation of people who have removal orders or have committed crimes while in the country, that would proceed over the next several days. Matt, let me start with you on this, because there was a lot made about this, mm-hmm. and a lot of local elected officials going public saying we've got your back. You know, we're not cooperating. But it sounds like that much of this kind of stuff that went on during the Obama administration.
Yeah, and I'm not sure because a lot of this was a press story, right? Everybody else, everyone's sort of waiting we're all sort of like, you know, perched like gargoyles waiting to say, and here it's going to begin, as if it's like the beginning of like the Indy 500 or something. So it was a very kind of odd way it happened. And then it just sort of petered out. And I'm not really sure why. I don't know if there was a PR tactic to this or some kind of strategy, or if this is just injecting this once again into the body politic. But I don't quite, if you're the president and you're going to tip this off, or whoever at the department is going to tip this off, and you're supposed to be the law and order candidate, I would think you're either going to do it or you're not going to. I don't see how it sort of benefits you to say we're going to do all these raids and sweep them up and get everybody ginned up on one side and get your supporters ginned up on the other and just have it kind of not happen. So to be honest, I was thinking about this on the way in. I'm not really sure what to make of it, because I'm just not sure why you put that out there if something's not going to happen.
Well, and I guess the issue was this going to lead to the arrests of individuals who had, you know, removal orders, whatever,
right,
and family members,
or collateral,
or, yes,
people caught up,
or
in
was it,
it
just going to be? So I guess that would be the different thing.
Yeah.
If family members who had no orders against them, no criminal records, they too were deported,
we're going to get swept up, which that has proven to be unpopular. And so, but again, I just don't know why this had to be put out there. To me, you're going to spin whatever you're going to spin. So if they want to have a bunch of raids and you don't sort of tip it off publicly, you can do that, and then make whatever case that you got rid of X amount of felons or people who are here illegally of final deportation orders. And sort of, if you're going to battle it out that way, or just don't do it. I just don't quite get the tipping it off, and then it kind of doesn't happen. And you still end up having the same arguments anyway, which is, are these people going to get caught up who are, you know, are undocumented but don't have final orders against them, or this is unfair? So I'm not quite sure what happened or why it happened, but I don't understand a lot that comes out of the administration sometimes, so maybe they're missing something.
All right. Sean, does it appear that there are going to be raids taking place over the next several days? What's the latest you've seen about this?
Well, there are raids all the time. The interesting thing is that some of the raids that were planned were leaked out by somebody within the Trump administration, you know, one of the deep state people, some Republicans think. And so when you do that, you undermine and you also potentially put the ICE officers in some harm's way by having people that may come out and try and stop them from enforcing the, what they feel is the law. So I think part of that's leaks. I don't know if they're trying to smoke some of the people out in the government that are leaking that information out. But, you know, as Matt noted, this happens really all the time. The Immigration Customs Enforcement Division has been doing these types of raids going back 40, 50 odd years. So the one thing that is worth noting It's not like they're going out and sweeping up Grandma and Uncle, you know, Jane and, you know, Uncle Jim. I mean, for the large part, about 8.5 to 9% of all of the people that are arrested or swept up in ICE raids are either criminals who've been convicted of crimes or those that are facing possible criminal or pending criminal charges. So it's, you know, it's not, like I say, there's a lot of political rhetoric on both sides of this issue. But with regards to what the government's doing, it's really not anything significantly different than what they've historically done.
One of the things, though, it does give Los Angeles officials an opportunity to connect with L.A. residents to make the point that they are against President Trump.
No matter their immigration status, I want every Angeleno to know their rights and how to exercise them. Remember, you have the right to remain silent. You don't have to open your door to an ICE agent that doesn't have a warrant signed by a judge. You have the right to speak to a lawyer before signing any documents or speaking to law enforcement. And if you need help finding an attorney, you can call 311 and learn more about our Justice Fund and other resources that offer legal support. And whenever possible, keep a record of everything that happens. Take note of an officer's name and badge number, of when and where you're being questioned, so you can use that information in your own defense. And most importantly, I want you to know you do not need to be afraid. Your city is on your side. And rest assured, here in Los Angeles, we are not coordinating with ICE.
That's L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti standing alongside LAPD Chief Moore in a video message to Angeleno. So, Matt, that does give leaders of cities like Los Angeles a chance to, you know, reinforce their difference from the president.
Their commitment. So some of it's political and no one's more cynical than I am. But also at the same time, there is, I think, real substance behind that. At the end of the day, a city like Los Angeles has a lot of is a very diverse place. You have a lot of people some who are here undocumented, some who have a lot of family members.
Within the same family.
Within the same family, living in the same place. And so at the end of the day, Garcetti's job is to be the mayor of all the people who are here. And while where we can debate what, you know, people who have crossed illegally and what should happen with them, you still have to keep some kind of like civil, you know, the cops need to be able to do their jobs. They need to be able to take care of the people who are here. And having this type of fear and concern running through those communities is just bad for the city. So this is going to play out on a national level, but I totally get where Garcetti's coming from, because at the end of the day, he needs to try to operate in good faith and try to take care of all the people who are here in some form. And it's a large population that's here, and sort of terrorizing those folks, even if some of those folks that they are getting rid of, maybe they do deserve to go back, maybe they don't, but it's a destabilizing force in a city that has this many immigrants from all over the world.
So Sean, what do you think of what leaders of cities like Los Angeles did to reassure residents?
Well, they're reassuring a segment of the public that is not legally here in this country. It's going to be interesting to see when all of these media events play out with regards to politicians in urban core cities, principally, that seem to be doing these events. You know, there are huge homeless problems. There's a lot of mental illness and drug problems. And so the roads are pretty bad in a number of different areas. So I'm curious to see, as we move into the presidential election, whether Trump in the back of his head is playing this out, saying, hey, look, you know what? So Eric Garcetti has, and he's already said this, has, you know, mentally ill, the homeless are on the streets, the roads are terrible. And now Garcetti and the rest of the Democrats of his ilk want to give Medicare for all, including any undocumented immigrant that comes across the border the second they get here. You get free school for the kids. You get free lunches. You get free breakfasts. You get free health care. You know, his argument's going to be, why in the heck wouldn't you want to come here? So I just think it's going to draw a very interesting contrast in whether the entire country is going to look and see the world like San Francisco and Los Angeles do. And I don't think that they actually do.
Well, polls indicate they don't, Matt, and that's what people are willing to say to pollsters.
Well, this is what I think Trump strategically thinks he's doing, is dragging Democrats into a far left kind of debate. But it's risky, though, too, because what's happening at the border, people are not happy about it. And why that's not 100% Trump's doing, this has been going on for a while. This is the battle. Like, so Democrats want to, I agree with Sean in that Democrats want to be careful about how far left and the giveaways they're going to be that they want to sort of signal that they're going to give. But the flip side is when people see kids being taken away or in cages or some of the problematic elements that are down on the border, that is much more favorable political territory for Democrats because it looks unfeeling. And Trump gives off no empathy for that, even though in a lot of ways you can make the case it's not 100% his fault. A lot of people are coming here. They're overwhelmed down there. We already saw the battle playing out between Nancy Pelosi and the squad to get back where we originally are. This is a challenging issue. It actually is a hard issue despite the black and white
nature. Yeah, this is what set this most recent thing off was the funding.
Was the funding and what's happening down there. And Trump has almost no ability or desire to make the case to say, like, look, we're doing that. But you can both be compassionate and say, we got to take care of these kids. There's 6 and 7 year olds down here who are, but at the same time, some of our policies are attracting other folks who have more kids coming in. We don't want to have that to happen. That kind of empathy was never installed in his hard drive. So he is unable to do that. And that is where I think he is vulnerable to a lot of those voters we were talking about earlier who find this problematic and really concerning. I agree with Sean. If you go too far left, there's a risk. But that's the political kind of fight that we're having right here. But this is an actual substantive issue that's difficult and challenging to square the circle on all of these issues.
We're talking with Matt Rodriguez and Sean Walsh, our political analysts this week. Secretary of Labor Alexander Acosta resigned as there was heavy criticism over the plea deal that he presided over with Jeffrey Epstein, who is now facing a variety of new serious charges alleging trafficking of minors for sexual purposes. Sean, it was interesting as I was reading some defenses of Acosta in the Wall Street Journal saying that, well, you know, this was a known deal and people didn't criticize it then. It's only now that there are more witnesses cooperating and alleged victims that are cooperating. You think Acosta had to go given the heavy criticism of him?
I think it was a benefit that played out on President Trump's behalf. So like everything else, there are a number of folks in the Trump administration, and particularly Nick Mulvaney, who have not been totally thrilled with Acosta. He's done a decent job, but he's not totally on the game plan with regards to being much more vigorous in undoing some of the regulations in the Labor Department that relate to certain unions. So the fact that he got into this problem and the fact that he got the hasta la vista presser while the whirl of the helicopter blades were going on Friday afternoon doesn't surprise me at all. So it killed two birds with one stone, a not entirely beloved member of the cabinet who wasn't doing exactly what the president wanted to have done.
Matt?
I thought when this thing popped up, Acosta was pretty much a dead man walking, and he was for all the obvious reasons. But I think the Epstein case is one of those rare cases that's almost a bipartisan outrage, not for really voters, because it has a very powerful guy with a lot of money doing stuff that's really bad, and he was getting away with it. And you know, he had that jail sentence, didn't last very long. He was going to work 6 days, but he was only sleeping at the jails.
And the victims were not told of the deal.
They were not told of the deal. And you're talking 14, 15-year-old girls. I mean, it's pretty horrific what he did, but he was also politically connected. He'd hung around with Donald Trump. He'd hung around with Bill Clinton. He's flying on private jets all over the world. And I think there's a unification on both sides. Trump's entire message is all these elites hate you. Elizabeth Warren and some of the Democrats' messages that this is rigged for the rich and the powerful. And Epstein was caught in the middle of that as a rich, powerful person who clearly, look, had this been somebody else, certainly a person of color, but either way, anybody who didn't have the kind of money he did, there would be a much more almost certainly serious charges leveled, and he would have gone to jail for a lot longer, much earlier, I think, in his life, when it seems like everyone kind of knew that this guy had a lot of dalliances with very young girls. So I think there was a sense that I think once you have that kind of political toxic atmosphere, I don't think he ever had a chance.
Well, and Acosta's argument was that he had limited cooperation from the victims in the case, and all that doesn't excuse that they weren't told, as they were legally
entitled
to be told about what the deal was. And they were, you know, he'd admitted he didn't inform them. And it's almost beside the point as to what, I mean,
from a political point of view, it's just not survivable. And the stuff that Epstein did is horrendous. And then I just think, again, had that been another case of someone who wasn't as wealthy and connected as Epstein who got that, I think it would have been bad enough. But I just think for where we are right now, having some billionaire flying around in private jets with girls at that age, I don't think it was survivable from a political perspective, no matter what the substance was. And the substance, to be honest, I think sounds pretty bad, too.
We're going to continue our conversation with Sean Walsh and Matt Rodriguez, checking in on the 2020 presidential candidates. We've had a dropout, and we've had someone come into the ring. We'll also talk about the rise in the poll of Sanders and Warren. We'll talk about what's going on with Joe Biden, those and more of the candidates to be talked about coming up. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC Southern California Public Radio. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Erdes. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. Larry Mantle coming up in our second hour. We're going to talk about that Silver Lake, a podiatrist sign, the rotating happy foot, sad foot. It's going to go away. Gives us a chance to talk about some of the fun, eccentric, or beautiful signs of Southern California, some in days past and others that are still out there. The Felix Chevrolet sign, which is one of the classics of Los Angeles. Every time I drive through downtown and I see Felix Chevrolet, I always love that sign of my boyhood. But I would love to, in our second hour, hear you weigh in on some of your favorites. Right now, we're talking politics with Matt Rodriguez and Sean Walsh. The 2020 presidential race heating up. Next week, two more of the Democratic candidates debates. And one of the things that we're seeing is one candidate exits, and Tom Steyer, the billionaire Californian who's been leading the impeachment move against President Trump, throwing his hat in the race. Sean, your thoughts about the shifting of the musical chairs at this early point?
Well, it's no surprise that Swalwell is out. He reminded me of the Kevin Bacon character in Animal House, where he gets stampeded and pressed flat to the ground. He had no constituency, no national profile other than the fact that he was born in Iowa. No surprise there. Now, Tom Steyer is an entirely different animal altogether, with a $1.6 billion bank account. He can spend, and he has demonstrated over the past decade that he will spend very, very heavily. He's been involved in the last three election cycles very heavily, spent about, you know, almost $70 million in the last midterm elections. I think he spent $100+ million to try and do ads in different parts of the country with regards to climate change, environmental issues. So he's got money, he's willing to spend, and if he is willing to do what most Democrats have not been willing to do, albeit Kamala Harris a little bit, Kamala Harris, which is actually spend money to attack other Democrats, I think he can be a big, big disruptor going into this election
cycle. Matt, do you agree with that?
I'm in a different place. I actually don't think he's going anywhere. I think that this is I think he's got a variety of problems. The first is he's a billionaire getting into a race when both sides of the party are being roiled by populists. So if he starts just spending a bunch of his money, that's going to be a huge story, and I'm not sure that's going to play particularly well. Number two, he's getting in very, very late. So where is he going to play? I don't think this is going to go over well in New Hampshire. And he's not a regional candidate, which is generally how those – if you go back 40 years, it's someone in the New England area tends to do pretty well in that. He's not even known here. And so he's going to – is he going to try to staff up in Iowa? Okay, it's almost August. So no matter how much money you have, it takes real effort to try to collect enthusiasm and organize folks to get to the caucuses. It isn't just a matter of blasting the air. He could blast television ads all over the place, and even if that works for him, it's not necessarily going to drive people to the caucuses. I think the third piece is, and I know some people work for him, so I'll probably get myself in trouble, but I'm not so sure how strategically smart the guy is. To be honest, he spent a lot of money. He's wasted a lot of money, too. He's poured a bunch of money in 2010 and 14 into congressional races. He's gotten crushed. He's run some carbon initiatives in different states. Some states he's won, some states he's not done so well in. So I'm not so sure. I guess maybe he can try to catch a wave in this impeachment thing, but he's getting in right as the impeachment talk is actually sort of petering out a little bit, and we're really starting to coalesce around Democratic candidates. So I just am not sure. I think everyone looks, well, he's got a big wallet. He's going to spend a bunch of money. Now, I do think Sean has one thing correct, which is if he just goes hog wild and starts just attacking people with a lot of money, that could be problematic. Yeah. And that could change the contours of the race. I don't see any scenario. Maybe I'll be proven wrong and I'll come back in 6 months and I'll be shocked. But I don't see any scenario where he really grabs a foothold. I just don't know what his constituency, who's voting for this guy. Just some guy who's getting in late who made a bunch of money, you know, in Wall Street and in the Kazana casino of gambling in a party that is royal by that. I mean, I think Elizabeth Warren will eat him for lunch on that issue. So.
Speaking of Elizabeth Warren, she really has catapulted herself both on the campaign trail and coming out of the last Democratic candidates debate to where she's polling very strongly. Joe Biden continues to lead in the polls that I've seen. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, right behind Kamala Harris, has risen significantly as well. Sean, do you think we're starting to see the longer term separating of the field, or is it too early to say that?
Well, there's, you know, 24 Democrats that are in this race. So Darwin will take effect and they'll start dying off by, you know, natural selection. So they will also start dying off insofar as what the party rules are with regards to what it takes to actually get into a debate. And so, again, the herd will be thinned, culled. The couple things that are important to know, again, from what Matt said, the one thing I did say is I'm not sure Tom Steyer will be successful. What I'm saying is he will be a disruptor. So, and Matt's absolutely right. You know, I know consultants who've worked for him. It's the full Consultant Employment Act. The guy's spent a ton of money. Oh, yeah. Matt's also right that he has not done.
It's like a pension fund.
So how did you two know this?
Yeah, it goes to show how smart we are. I'll tell you what.
But the other thing, though, that he has done is he had better success. I'm not sure it was him or whether it was just the dynamic of the last election cycle. But prior to that, Matt's absolutely right. He's not had very good success with any of the candidates he's backed or the initiatives he's backed in various states. And he has been disruptive. And so if he goes very heavy in a very liberal activist way and spends a ton of money doing that, that just reinforces what Donald Trump has been saying, that the Democrats are extreme, you know, they're problematic, etc. And Matt's also right, too. Generally, people don't like billionaires who come in, throw their money around and run. That's true for Republicans as well as Democrats. Mitt Romney, who was a pretty decent guy for all intent and purposes, gave tons of money to charity, was a, great guy. He got, you know, pilloried by the Democrats. It really hurt him. It cost him with some of the Republicans. So, and Matt's right again, too, that with regards to, I don't see the Democrats embracing a guy who's a billionaire and can write his own check. So with regards to Elizabeth Warren, though, if a guy like Tom Steyer went after her and, you know, fought her kind of toe to toe on the progressive side, he can do her some damage. And if you're a Republican and you're sitting here, what you want to see is you want the Democrats to start damaging each other and softening up the beachhead before the general election.
Yeah, I guess it's just hard for me to, you know, she's become very deft and it's hard for me to imagine him inflicting that kind of serious damage.
Well, in which
her.
Direction does he go after her on? She was the first to call for impeachment. She's pushing the economic populist message. Look, she's running, and I've said this before on this, I did not see her running this great a campaign. She's running the best campaign right now. Doesn't mean she's going to be the nominee. Doesn't mean she doesn't have some vulnerabilities, but she is running the best campaign of any of the candidates right now. It's the heaviest on policy. She's also setting a lot of the agenda on politics, but she's able to get into the political realm, like calling for Trump's impeachment. She'll attack him today, I'm sure, on the racist stuff, but she'll get back to what her core message is, which is, you know, that powerful entities are out to, you know, people are doing well, but you could be doing better. She's very good about connecting in the early states so far. She's just running an excellent campaign, and she raised almost $20 million, 19.1. So she had looked a little bit, she looked very shaky when she first got in with the Native American video and Trump going after her. It really looked like she was kind of in big trouble.
The social media thing she did
was just horrific.
Yeah, she really got off on the wrong foot, turned it around.
Totally turned it around, and she's done it. And she's done it by what a lot of folks don't do. She's doing it by doing what she does well. She's a policy wonk. She's passionate about it. She sticks to the things that she's strong on. Now, she's got weaknesses that are not showing yet because it's early. But for where we are right now, I think she's running the most competent and effective campaign of any of the candidates in the field.
I want to go back to our conversation of last Friday about the squad, the four new members of Congress who were in a conflict with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Sean, before this all, you know, was superseded by President Trump's tweet yesterday, how beneficial or not is the infighting to President Trump's hopes of being reelected?
It's tremendously beneficial. So, you know, the Democrats, I've said this before in the show, when the bear is chasing you, you only have to be that little bit faster than the guy or gal that's right next to you or slightly behind you. And so if the Democrats do what historically they do, which is attack each other on a variety of issues and divide up themselves, then that's beneficial to President Trump and in large part to Republicans. I think at the end of the day, the question is going to be, I think Democrats for the most part will support any of the nominees, even a Warren or a Sanders or someone else along those lines. So elections are decided by a very, very thin sliver of the electorate, as the Electoral College is principally the determining factor. And I still have serious questions as to whether the Democrats have thought through what they're going to do to take moderate to conservative Democrats in between the two coasts, the big cream filling of the Oreo cookie, and how they're going to appeal to them. Now, Joe Biden was supposed to be that guy. He was, Democrat establishment. People have known him and seen him, trusted, right hand of President Obama, etc. But I think his campaign right now, he's just running a little bit like Jeb Bush did. I'm basically the presumptive nominee. Everybody likes me. And, I'm going to run a, almost incumbent type of campaign. So I do think Biden is still probably the strongest candidate to defeat Donald Trump in the general election.
Well, and Trump's sure acting like he is.
Yep, he is. And so, and when you look at the polling, so even though Warren does well in the polling and Mayor Pete does well, I think the very, very interesting thing is that the Republicans, that Netroots conference that happened over the weekend, they will do anything to see anybody to knock Trump out.
We'll continue our conversation with Sean and Matt back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Larry Mantle with Matt Rodriguez and Sean Walsh. One of the differences between the Democratic candidates that we're seeing is on health care. Pretty much all of the candidates, with the exception of Joe Biden, are touting Medicare for all. But in the case of Biden, he said that would mean doing away with the Affordable Care Act. And he has really linked himself with President Obama, said this is the signature initiative of the Obama presidency. How could Democrats essentially want to undo this and replace it with something that is riskier? Matt, your thoughts about Biden choosing to split from the field on this issue?
Yeah, I've been waiting for it. About time. But I do think this is sort of you go to your movies and you watch your coming attractions. This is the coming attractions. There's so much press in the summer before any presidential year. But at the end of the day, a lot of this is just sort of, building the foundation, the bricks and mortar. We're going to start to see this play a lot more out after Labor Day and going into the fall. And this is a big fault line. We've all been waiting for it. It's all going to come. And I think I do think some of the stuff on open borders, and I think healthcare is going to be a big one. And I think that Biden is making the bet, and I think it's probably a good bet, frankly, that people are not ready to see their healthcare, their private healthcare, get taken away. Democrats want more people to have healthcare, but even those Democrats, a lot of them are going to like the healthcare that they have. And when you ask these questions in a vacuum, like Medicare for all, it tests very well. The minute you start sitting there saying, well, are you going to give up your health care for this? Or do you know that your specialist might mean you may need to see somebody else, or this particular prescription drug that you take will mean it's going to be something different? Support typically plummets. And this argument around healthcare is not going to play out in a vacuum. It is going to start playing out. And Biden is going to start asking the other candidates, one about this one. And we've seen Kamala Harris. She's had two or three bites at this apple, and she screwed it up every single time. So And it's very difficult to sit there and answer questions. You know, Bernie will be very upfront and say, we're just going to have everyone's going to get Medicare for all and you're going to save money. But he's even himself has admitted this is going to be a huge $1 trillion tax increase. So I think everything from the increased revenue that this is going to cost to whether you're going to be able to keep your doctor, keep your specialist, what it's going to look like in terms of the amount of time you're going to need before you when you want to see a doctor when you can, those arguments are going to be pushed back on the Medicare for all folks. And I think even within a Democratic primary, I think a lot of those lefty Democrats are vulnerable from the right. And I think it makes sense for Biden to be in this place. Final thing I'll say is being for Obamacare helps him have an island to go to be. It isn't just attacking from the right. He's saying, well, why don't we build an Obamacare?
Yeah, he's linking himself to a popular
president. To a popular president. And I think that is it gives him some North Star to constantly look to, as opposed to just sort of saying this, criticizing Medicare for all in a vacuum.
Sean, I wonder, though, if let's say Biden's not the nominee, another one of the Democrats who says Medicare for all is the way to go, President Trump in presidential debates have enough grasp of the economics of healthcare that he's going to be really able to go after that and talk about what the trade-offs involved in Medicare for all would be.
Well, when you're trying to explain something that I think is fairly complex, and Medicare for all is, it seems like it's simple, but it isn't simple. And so I think the president can take 2, 3, 4 bullet points, distill it down to a bumper sticker and make whoever the person is who's articulating or advocating for that position, really, really look bad from a cost perspective. The one thing I will say with regards to Obamacare, Republicans originally hated it. They wanted to repeal it, take it all the way to the kind of end of the degree. But what they found out is that once you give away benefits to people, they kind of don't want to have those benefits taken away. And so a lot of Republicans have found out that in their districts that the Obamacare is somewhat popular. And like I say, giving it back is not going to work. So I think if Biden played that, he could actually use that as a very powerful political tool.
How could they not understand that, Sean? I mean, that just seems so self-evident when you heavily subsidize people's health care insurance and they can buy it through an exchange. And they didn't have health insurance, significant number of those people before. How could Republicans not have understood they would meet a high degree of unpopularity with repeal?
Well, the issue is once you let the camel's nose under the tent, people are going to like it. Once you give when the
but
Republicans
you're
all
they
backed,
didn't know that. How could they have not known?
Oh no,
that?
They knew it. They knew it. I mean, so in the old days, Republicans really, really were concerned about spending, runaway government spending. And so under this president and prior presidents, whatever, regulation that seemed to be on to keep people from just going hog wild crazy and spending anything and everything has gone away. And so, it's a fun party until the music stops and everything comes crashing down. I'm a big believer in, debt as it destroys countries. It's destroyed nations over the history of at least going back to, 1000 BC. And so I just think that with regards to this issue, the Republicans have decided that they would rather live politically than die holding out for that issue.
Yeah, and they didn't even frame it as an issue of governmental expenditures. They framed it as repeal and replace with something better.
But which they didn't have.
There was nothing.
No, and I think in some ways your question, Larry, I think actually it's easier for Trump to fight on Medicare for all because I think he can just get up there and say you're going to have trillions of dollars worth of tax increases, you're going to lose your doctor, and he'll have these stories of like Larry needed to get a kidney and he waited 4 months and died. That's really what the debate will be. I think on Obamacare, I think it's tougher ground. You saw that for as much as people think Trump is unpopular, the 2018 referendum elections were off on a referendum on Republicans looking to take away folks' health care. They don't have a plan for health care. There's this issue going through the courts now as to whether Obama is unconstitutional again. And we saw the Republicans, it was a very good political winner for them both in 2010 and 14, even in 16. And then the minute they got the Congress, we got it all. What's your repeal and replace idea? And they couldn't pass anything because they didn't have an idea. So I think actually Obamacare is more challenging territory for Trump because it's actually taking away something from voters that he would be doing as opposed to Medicare for all, which would be actually taking away stuff from folks. So I think he would rather fight in the Medicare for all.
All right. I want to go back to our opening topic just real quickly. Matt, does President Trump's weekend tweet do ongoing damage to him?
I think, yes, I don't want to make it more than it is, but I think it's just one more brick in the wall of people saying this guy is just really just divisive. And I think the types of voters he's going to need in his camp, he's continued to alienate.
Sean, is this one above and beyond other outrageous tweets and do ongoing damage to him?
It's near the borderline, but again, it's distilling his America, love it or leave it strategy or policy. So I don't think it does ongoing damage.
Gentlemen, thank you. Appreciate it. Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic analyst. We have much more to talk about, including immigration issues, in our second hour of Air Talk here on 89.3 KPECC. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. Yes, we have a lot of heavy news we're talking about on this Monday, but coming up later this hour, we get a break from it. We talk about your favorite business signs in Southern California. This with the future demise of the happy foot, sad foot revolving sign of Silver Lake, which has given a chuckle to many people as they've driven by. Do you have a favorite unusual sign or beautiful sign of past years or present? You can share that with us later this hour on Air Talk. But we begin with a couple of significant immigration stories. First, this morning, the Trump administration said it will end asylum protections for most migrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. This is a new rule that was published in the Federal Register, and it would mean that refugees coming from Central American countries would be expected to ask for asylum in Mexico, and that they would be ineligible under the terms of this rule for refugee status in the United States. Joining us to talk about it is Cindy Carcamo, reporter covering immigration for the Los Angeles Times. Cindy, thank you for being with us. First, what is the process for this rule? And I assume it's open for legal challenge now.
Definitely. It's likely going to end up in the courts. In effect, this rule is going to nearly wipe out U.S. asylum law. U.S. asylum law establishes, a legal right to claim protection for anyone who arrives at the U.S. border and can make a case that they face torture or persecution at home. And this law applies regardless of how a migrant reaches the border. So this will definitely change that. But I suspect that it's going to be challenged in the courts.
All right. Also, we had raids that were widely reported to get underway yesterday by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Earlier this morning, this is what President Trump had to say about the raids.
People came into our country illegally. Many were felons. Many were convicted of crimes. Many were taken out on Sunday. You just didn't know about it. In fact, I went to, I spoke to the head of ICE. I spoke to a couple of people. We had many people. It was a very successful day, but you didn't see a lot of it because it was done a lot. You'll speak to them. And I'm not even sure they should be telling you, but it was a lot. And it wouldn't have to be Sunday. We've been doing this.
President Trump saying that the actions were very successful. Cindy Carcamo, do we know whether there were such raids taking place in Southern California yesterday?
No. The reports that we got actually just throughout the nation, there were scattered attempts and failed attempts as well. So really, I think what he's saying is a real departure from what it seems actually happened on the ground. But it's interesting because you'll talk to immigration experts, analysts who've been following this for quite some time now, and it really, the numbers would have been minuscule if they were aiming for about 2,000. That was about the goal, more or less. That is a statistical drop in the bucket to how many people we have with removal orders in this country, which is nearly 1 million people. And even so, it doesn't seem like we even got close to the 2,000 number. But I guess, you know, a lot of experts will say, and people that I've spoken with who've been following this will say, that the numbers really don't matter at this point, because the rhetoric is so out there, and the rhetoric is enough to scare people to stay home, and it's enough to stoke fear, it's enough to kind of placate his base, Donald Trump's base. So it's an interesting dynamic that we're in right now.
Well, and I think one of the big concerns was, were the people who were going to be taken into ICE custody just those who had removal orders or who had been convicted of crimes? Or were these going to be family members who were in the country illegally but had no removal orders, hadn't been through the criminal justice system? Was this going to extend to them? And have we had any clarification on that, Cindy?
Well, Immigration and Customs Enforcement said that they would go after people with final removal orders and recent arrivals. Basically, this would have been part of the recent asylum seekers, right, who had a date in court and didn't show up or didn't meet the asylum threshold. It wasn't going to just be them, though, because they also talked about collateral arrests. So people who just happen to be, you know, in the vicinity or in the household who are in the country without legal status. And so it's really unclear. I mean, this is what Immigration and Customs Enforcement was saying, but the way it translated on the ground was that anyone could be picked up. And so I tell you, I mean, I had people who were texting me on Sunday morning, sources of mine, people who are in the country, who are immigrants, who have visas, who were afraid, who were not going to be going to work, who were going to hunker down for about a week, actually, and take time off of work because they were scared that they might get kind of picked up. And even people who were in the country without legal status, who came in undetected, who the system probably don't have any way, I mean, ICE probably doesn't have any way of knowing whether they're here illegally or whether they're even here. And those people were also scared because they thought they could get picked up. So I think there's a lot of confusion on the ground, and it's unclear really as to whether it would have just targeted people with removal orders. You know, obviously there would be collateral arrest, but it's unclear because really it went off with a whimper on Sunday.
Cindy, thank you so much for updating us both on this federal rule requested by the administration on changing refugee status as well as deportations throughout the country and here in Southern California. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Cindy Carcamo is Los Angeles Times reporter covering immigration issues. Also with us is Claude Arnold, who's a consultant at Frontier Solutions, crisis management firm. But he's retired special agent in charge of ICE for over a decade here in Southern California and Southern Nevada. Claude, it's good to have you with us again on the program. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on how ICE conducts these operations and whether there typically are collateral family members who are also removed as a part of these actions?
Sure, yeah, but if I could comment first on the assertion that this new rule would virtually wipe out the existing asylum law.
You want to go back to the refugee thing? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So I think that's an overstatement. What the rule does is it says that those, as you pointed out, transiting a third country, if they had not applied for asylum there first, they wouldn't be eligible. So, and it's important to note that more than 80% of those who have an initial finding of credible fear are either found to not be eligible for asylum, don't have a valid asylum claim, or they just don't apply. So there's a real problem with people using that loophole just to get their foot in the door to get in the country. And that's what this rule was really designed to address. And it's not without precedent. In the 90s, we had a similar situation. I remember I lived through it, where people automatically were granted work authorization if they filed for asylum in the U.S. So you can just imagine what a draw that was for people from Central America, not just Central America, Mexico as well. Even though they were frivolous asylum claims, they knew that they would get automatic work authorization. So that rule, that regulation was changed to get rid of that magnet for people to come to the U.S. illegally.
All right. And Claude, also, maybe you could elaborate. I thought there was also some sort of international refugee agreement in which the first country that people travel through that's a signatory to that agreement, that's where they're expected to request asylum. And I thought Mexico was a signatory to that.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's the purpose of this rule. And what that indicates is people would rather come to the U.S. and they'd rather come to the U.S. because there's more economic opportunity, and they're actually economic refugees, not political refugees. So the vast majority. Now there's definitely some people who have valid claims for political asylum, and those will continue to be able to pursue those claims, but they should pursue them in the first country of transit pursuant to international treaties.
We're talking with Claude Arnold. He was the special agent in charge of ICE for over a decade in Southern California and Southern Nevada, currently consultant of Frontier Solutions. Also with us is Robin Barnard, who is staff attorney with Human Rights First LA office. That's a human rights nonprofit for those who are seeking asylum in the United States. Ms. Barnard, thank you for being with us. Do you see this as a thoroughgoing shift in U.S. asylum policy?
Yes, thanks for having me, Larry. I did want to just clarify one thing that you mentioned at the start, that this rule would not only apply to Central American asylum seekers, it would in fact apply to any asylum seeker, regardless of their current country of origin, who seeks protection at our southern border. So that's the first thing I just wanted to...
And there are people that come from a wide range of countries seeking asylum at the southern border.
Yes, I have had clients from Eritrea, from Burkina Faso, from Georgia, from Russia, who have taken that route because they have no other option to get here and seek asylum safely.
All right. And do you see this proposed new federal rule as essentially undoing U.S. refugee policy?
Absolutely. It's another attempt by the Trump administration to rewrite the laws that Congress passed to protect refugees from return to persecution. And this specific rule addresses an issue that Congress specifically contemplated when they were creating our laws of refugee protection, and that's the firm resettlement bar. So there is already in place a bar to asylum that addresses this specific issue, but that was a rule that was put in place by Congress. It was thought out. There are exceptions for those who experience harm in a country that where they were living. So, for example, an LGBT asylum seeker who was living in a third country before coming to seek protection at our southern border may be able to qualify for an exception to that firm resettlement bar. There are no such exceptions to this proposed rule. And from our perspective, it is going to do great harm to asylum seekers and refugees that have very genuine protection needs. And it's just another attempt to bypass Congress by trying to put in place an asylum ban. And we've already seen what has happened when they've attempted to do a similar asylum ban earlier in 2018, which the federal courts promptly blocked. So I see this as just another attempt to block genuine asylum seekers and refugees from protection that they greatly need.
Ms. Barnard, why wouldn't refugee seekers make the request of Mexico when they're seeking to enter the U.S. from the southern border? They're in Mexico. Mexico has a refugee policy. Why wouldn't those individuals seek refugee status with Mexico first?
That's a great question. I mean, there are a few different potential reasons. Of the asylum seekers that I speak to regularly, some of the most common things that they recount is first that they're not aware that there is a right to seek asylum in Mexico. There aren't great resources given by the Mexican government to the asylum process in that country. And in fact, The backlog of asylum applications pending in Mexico has grown exponentially in the last 5 years, at least. So that's the first thing, that there's lack of awareness, and there's also a lack of resources devoted to actually processing those asylum applications. But then also, secondly, many asylum seekers don't believe it's safe and are not safe in Mexico. We've heard many stories of individuals who've been returned to Mexico under the Remain in Mexico policy that I believe you mentioned earlier, who have been raped, they've been kidnapped and beaten, they've been held for ransoms by cartel groups in Mexico. So we have, you know, so many stories that are really disturbing and very concerning about the dangers that asylum seekers face in Mexico, either en route to seek protection at the U.S. border or after they've been returned by the U.S. to Mexico to wait for their asylum cases. I myself have two clients who are stuck in Mexico right now waiting for their immigration hearings, and they're terrified. They stay in the homes where they're able to shelter. They don't have any right to work in Mexico, so they have no means of making any money to pay for shelter, for food. One of my clients has epilepsy, and he's not able to afford the medication he needs. And then on top of that, we've heard more concerning stories of asylum seekers who've had those very serious experiences of harm while they've been waiting in Mexico.
We're talking with Robin Barnard of Human Rights First. She's staff attorney in the Los Angeles office of the nonprofit organization. Claude Arnold, also with us, retired special agent in charge, Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Southern California and Southern Nevada. Claude, do you want to respond to that for many of those seeking refugee status, that it's not safe for them to do so in Mexico?
Well, you know, obviously I can't speak for the conditions in Mexico. I mean, it's not hard to cite some anecdotal examples of where people are victimized. I mean, let's face it, Mexico is a violent country, and these people have entered into contracts with criminal organizations in many cases to be smuggled to the U.S. For payment. So, you know, a lot of this is a byproduct of making a deal with the devil.
Claude Arnold will continue with us on Air Talk. I want to thank you, Robin Barnard, for being with us, Human Rights First. Coming up, we turn our attention to the use by Immigration and Customs Enforcement of facial recognition data that in some cases is obtained from driver's licenses. We'll talk about the concerns that raises for civil libertarians. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Federal agents with Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the FBI reportedly used driver license photos for facial recognition requests. That, according to new research from Georgetown University School of Law Center on Privacy and Technology. The Washington Post first reported on a series of documents, emails, and facial recognition requests obtained via public records, which Georgetown Law School shared with them. Joining us from the Center for Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law, Senior Associate Claire Garvey. She led the research into the use of DMV driver license images for law enforcement facial recognition technology. Ms. Garvey, thank you very much for being with us. How widely are these images used?
Face recognition searches on driver's license photos is very common. At least 44 states have face recognition systems that run on driver's licenses, and in 32 of those states, at least, searches are available to be conducted by law enforcement. About 21 of those states allow the FBI to search or to request searches. We don't know how common it is for ICE to request searches, but it happens in at least it has happened in at least 4 states that we're aware of.
And what are the concerns that civil liberties advocates have raised over using a driver's license image as part of facial recognition tech?
One is that this is unprecedented. Never before have we allowed criminal justice searches, biometric criminal justice searches, on a majority of law-abiding Americans. And now this is happening in the absence of laws. With regards to ICE access of DMV info and, to an extent, FBI access, this in many ways, in some states, is a subversion of state will. State legislatures in Utah and Arizona and other states have been very clear that they do not want this information shared with the federal government, and yet their executive agency, their DMV, has gone ahead and begun sharing this information anyway. So in many ways, this is a breakdown of the democratic process by which state citizens, through their legislatures, choose to have this information shared.
And have those states, to your knowledge, refused to allow their driver's license databases to be used by federal agencies?
So after the Real ID Act passed, which required a certain amount of information sharing with the federal government, half of all states actually passed laws initially refusing compliance. And many of those laws were in the spirit of not wanting to share DMV information with the federal government, that they thought that was a violation of federalism, of states' autonomy under our Constitution.
All right. But with like California, for example, now has introduced Real ID as a driver's license that can be used in lieu of a passport, for example, for domestic air travel. Are those images automatically then being supplied to the federal government?
To my knowledge, licenses that are compliant with Real ID, I don't know the extent to which that information is directly shared with the federal government. What's happening regarding ICE, however, is that 13 states and Washington, D.C. allow undocumented immigrants, encourage undocumented immigrants to get driver's licenses. These will not be Real ID compliant, but they do encourage them. It's legal under state law, and yet then this information has been turned around and shared with ICE without the public's knowledge.
We're talking with Claire Garvey of the Center for Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. She's led the research into how some states share their DMV driver's license information with the FBI and with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Also with us, Claude Arnold, continuing from our last segment, former special agent in charge of ICE in Southern California. Claude, how frequently are driver's license images used, do you think, for this kind of technology by ICE to identify people's immigration status?
As far as using it for immigration status, I can't say because I've never been involved in that process. But I can tell you what's often lost on people is that ICE has a very robust investigative mission. And so The portion of ICE that I was in charge of, Homeland Security Investigation, is the second largest investigative agency in the United States government after the FBI, in investigating all types of criminal activity, drug smuggling, weapons smuggling. So, you know, it's not counterproliferation, that is the illegal export of technology to countries like Korea, China, etc. So their mission is very big, diverse, and it's not just the immigration aspect. So the people using this investigative tool could be using it for something and likely are using it for things other than immigration, and certainly not civil immigration, because that component of ICE, their mission is a criminal investigative mission, not civil immigration enforcement. So that's important to point out.
All right.
So this is a very useful investigative tool. And I'll give you an example. Early on in my career, this is in the mid-90s, I was investigating transnational gangs in Phoenix, Arizona, so criminal street gangs. And I was investigating a case where street gang members had taken hostage some smuggled people at gunpoint from a human smuggling organization. Okay, this was very routine in the mid-90s, and often the people would get caught in the crossfire and they would be murdered, even killed. So very violent activity. Well, we were able to identify some of the people who abducted these people who have been smuggled into the U.S. because during the search warrant, we found a photograph at that location, and we're able to bounce that off of to various databases. And it didn't involve DMV information, but various databases that this City of Phoenix PD held and, you know, booking, I think it was Maricopa County Sheriff's Office booking data, and we were able to identify one of the subjects of the investigation through that technology. And this is in the mid-90s. So, you know, it definitely has a place, photo recognition software. Another example, real quickly, when I was a special agent in charge in Minnesota, they had a problem with people assuming the identities of U.S. citizens of Puerto Rican descent and then getting driver's licenses. And they had thousands of records within their DMV database where they had multiple people with the same identity but different photos, right? So obviously that was indicative. If you have people with three, four different faces using the same identity, that's indicative of obvious fraud and identity theft. And this software was able to be used to identify instances where people were engaged in identity theft, which is, you know, obviously a pretty serious both state and federal felony.
And in that investigation in Minnesota, Claude, did you have to use a warrant to get access to driver license images to try and pin this down, or was this considered to be a publicly available database for law enforcement for your agency to use?
Well, we weren't. It was a joint investigation.
Okay.
So, the state of Minnesota, the authorities were involved in the investigation. So it wasn't the federal government saying, you know, we weren't doing it unilaterally.
Claude Arnold, retired special agent in charge with Immigration and Customs. Claire Garvey of the Georgetown Law Center for Privacy and Technology. Claire, you want to respond to what Claude was just saying about how this could have, you know, importance when it comes to criminal investigations like this?
Face recognition is undoubtedly a tool that can be used for public safety purposes. I understand that it could have incredible benefits for investigating serious crimes. However, there are a couple of issues with that. One is that I don't think it would be too much to ask for the legislature to sign off on that, for the citizens of a given state to have to approve that type of use of their data before law enforcement is able to use that. And again, this is unprecedented. We've never had biometric databases of law-abiding citizens before that are just available to any law enforcement agency, local, state, or federal. We've never had that before.
And you think the technology changes the nature of this as opposed to an agent sitting down manually going through photos as opposed to running large numbers of photos through software?
Definitely. It's an economies of scale issue. So if an agent were to need to manually review the photos in a DMV database, that would take time, so that would necessarily be limited to the most serious crimes. Whereas if it's just a click of a button, or you can do multiple searches a minute or every few minutes, that means you can essentially search for everybody. And so with the absence of rules governing when this can be used, what we're going to start seeing, what we are seeing with face recognition, is it's not just limited to looking for serious crimes or suspects in crimes at all. It's used to find the girlfriend of a suspected criminal or somebody who is asking suspicious questions or people who are not actually or witnesses to a crime, perhaps. This is vastly broadening the scope of what's historically been capable, been able to be done by law enforcement, and it's been done in the absence of rules.
There have been court cases, as I recall, that established seeking a driver's license as a privilege, not a right, which would seem to afford to, you know, government a greater degree of ability to use that information, because people aren't compelled to get a driver's license, although in Southern California it can seem that way. What do you think is the legal precedent for this?
So I do think for a lot of people who live in rural America, I grew up in rural upstate New York, driving may be on paper a privilege, it is very much a necessity when it comes to holding a job and driving your children to school. I think a lot of people would take issue with its classification as a voluntary, as a privilege. The other thing is, when we look at ICE access to DMV info, what we're seeing is a state like Utah has affirmatively requested that undocumented immigrants go through a legal process to provide this information to the state. And they viewed it as a public safety issue, that they want everybody on the streets to be driving after passing a competency exam and having car insurance to keep everybody more safe.
So they don't want to discourage people from getting licenses.
Certainly. And turning around and sharing that information with ICE will discourage people. And that, in my view, is a direct tension between the interests and actions of the federal government, of ICE, and the interests of a state legislature who should be the ones deciding what the access and use of this information is.
Claire Garvey, thank you for being with us from the Center for Privacy Technology at Georgetown Law. Claude Arnold, quick closing thought from you about this.
So I agree. Look, this is new technology, and it's something that probably needs to be reviewed by the courts to determine legally, because you're absolutely right. Currently, there's plenty of legal precedent relating to revoking driver's licenses, for example, for a DUI, if someone fails to take a breathalyzer test or do a blood test. Many states have that. And the courts have decided, look, a driver's license is a privilege. So I think what has to happen is the courts have to weigh in and decide whether or not people who voluntarily give their picture for a driver's license, for example, whether or not they have a reasonable expectation of privacy to that photo when they've voluntarily given it up. So,
all right. Claude, thank you so much. Claude Arnold, working two segments for us today on Air Talk. He was special agent in charge with ICE for over a decade, overseeing aspects of ICE investigations in Southern California and Southern Nevada. Coming up on Air Talk, we've gotten word that in Silver Lake, the Happy Foot Sad Foot Podiatrist revolving sign is going to be going away. But this raises the question of what are some of the other signs in Southern California you think are notable or quirky or fun or maybe beautiful, beloved, that you'd hate to see them go, or maybe they've already gone, but you fondly recall them. 866-893-KPECC. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. I was reading in Frank Xiong's column in the Los Angeles Times about a story that apparently was first reported in the East Sider, that Dr. Thomas Lim's Sunset Foot Clinic is going to be moving, and as a result, that revolving sign with the cartoon foot, tennis shoe clad cartoon foot with hands coming out of the side of the foot, is going to be going away. The revolving sign, one of the few revolving signs left in L.A., grandfathered in after the city banned those. But it's also one that's funny and quirky and, you know, one of those totally original signs that have been a hallmark of Los Angeles ever since the beginning of our car-centric culture, whether it's neon signs, huge signs to be seen from freeways, revolving signs, whether it's businesses that are in the shape of the item they sell, like Randy's Donuts in Inglewood's, programmatic architecture as it's known. You know, we've been the home for that kind of stuff. And this is an opportunity, with Happy Foot, Sad Foot going away, for you to talk about what signs you love most here in Southern California, the business signs that you think about fondly when you go by them, as well as some that have been long gone, but you might fondly remember from your childhood. 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Hal in Los Feliz, your favorite of the unique signs.
Hi, Larry. First time, long time.
Thanks.
So, oh, absolutely. So there's, in North Hollywood, there's a liquor store called Circus Liquor.
Yes.
And there's, the representative, sign wise is this giant neon clown. And I love that it's this juxtaposition of things. It's representing a liquor store, which is adult, but it's this childlike thing and like a circus clown. And
I know.
Well, it's been in many movies, Hal. I don't know if you've seen it, but there are so many movies that have been set in the parking lot of that liquor store or with that sign in it. So you're not alone in your appreciation of it.
Oh, yeah. I love just it's just seeing it against the horizon. It's beautiful. But if I was a child and I saw that clown, it would haunt my nightmare.
Right. Hal, thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, KPECC.org. Now, you know, in Glendale, the Museum of Neon Art has its exhibitions with all these wonderful old neon signs in L.A. And for me, when I go through it, I feel like I'm revisiting my boyhood. There's the swimsuit-clad woman who's diving into the pool, and you see the progression of the dive through neon. I remember going by that sign in my childhood time after time after time. What about the mobile Pegasus neon sign that so many of the mobile gas stations had at night? It would light up those gas stations so brightly with Pegasus flashing at the mobile gas station. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, KPECC.org. Muhammad in Hollywood says, I also love the Circus Liquors sign. It's my favorite part of the valley, and because I grew up there, it always reminds me of being home. That's Muhammad in Hollywood. Mike in Echo Park says, 20 years ago in Koreatown, I saw a sign for eye surgery, but surgery was spelled S-E-R-G-E-R-Y on the sign. I said, I'm not going to get my eyes checked by that guy. That's Mike in Echo Park, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page. Yeah, misspellings are a whole other category of funny signs where terms have been misspelled. Jonah in Silver Lake said, my favorite was Ships, the coffee shop at La Cienega and Olympic. Big circle with a rocket ship going through it, closed maybe 15 years ago, but a landmark, and they kept the sign up after the building was allowed to fall apart. Yeah, Jonah, I remember Ships, and there was more than one of them. There were so many of the signs, you know, from the 1960s that had that space age sort of feel to it. Appropriate. We talk about that this week heading into the 50th anniversary of the moon landing and first moonwalk. But, that was another part of the Southern California signage was sort of paying homage to the space age. Nick in Hollywood, your favorite LA sign. Nick, you there?
Oh, yeah, sorry about that. I just wanted to shout out about the Felix Chevrolet sign.
Yes.
On Figueroa and Jefferson. I have no idea why Felix the Cat is on that sign, but it's iconic. It's everybody knows that character.
Yeah, absolutely. And the sign is huge. I'm sure it would never be licensed today. They would never allow a sign that big to go up, but you can't miss it. It's another one for those of us that grew up in Los Angeles. We've known the Felix Chevrolet sign for many, many years. Plus, they used to advertise back in the 60s and 70s on TV all the time, so you'd constantly see that Felix sign. You couldn't escape it. And it's interesting because they're tapping into what was a very popular cartoon character to promote the car dealership. 866-893-KPCC. Marion Glendora says, many years ago, there was a church with a sign that said, Jesus saves. Also blue chip stamps, and it looked like it was all one. Jesus saves blue chip stamps. That's very funny. Well, the famous Jesus Saves sign in Los Angeles was atop the old Church of the Open Door in downtown L.A., And when the church moved to the San Gabriel Valley and no longer kept their downtown L.A. location, Gene Scott, the TV pastor who, in fact, used to own the theater at Ace Hotel, that was his, I think he called it University Cathedral, I believe, Gene Scott bought those Jesus Save signs, and I think there may be one that his widow still has, if I'm not mistaken. It's not on display, I don't think. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Sean and Arlita has one of my favorites from the LAX area. Maybe you can guess which one it is. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about your favorite sign in Southern California. Can be of the past, no longer on display, or one that's there currently. This in light of the Happy Foot, Sad Foot sign, as it's known, on the revolving pole at the Silver Lake podiatrist practice of Dr. Thomas Lim. Dr. Lim's a KPCC listener and called us to talk about the sign at his Sunset Foot Clinic. Dr. Lim, are you surprised that your sign has become so beloved?
I am actually very surprised. When I first started working here 12 years ago, I didn't realize how important it was. But then over the years, everyone was telling me their little personal stories about seeing the Happy Foot, Sad Foot sign as they drive by and how it usually foretold their future.
Wow. So people imbued it with fortune-telling ability?
Apparently so, yes. It's a clairvoyant, apparently.
Depending on which side they saw when they came down the street. Now, do you know the story? Can you share the story of how the sign came to be?
Actually, I don't know the story. That's part of its myth. It now becomes legend because the sign's been around since the early 80s, but actually I don't remember the first doctor that put it up or who even designed it. All I know is it's so old that the phone number doesn't even have the area code in front of it because back then there was only one area code.
All right. Dr. Lim, you're moving to another location, is that right?
Yeah, so the area we're moving to, it's going to be on Virgil between Beverly and First. It's called Rampart Village, so that's right next to Virgil Village, which is probably what Silver Lake used to be like 15 years ago before it became the destination that it is now.
But you can't take the sign with you, I understand.
Yeah, I don't think I can because I guess the laws of L.A. City won't allow me to have a pole with a revolving sign anymore.
All right. Dr. Lim, thanks. We'll let you get back to patients. Really appreciate your stepping out for a moment. Okay. No pun intended. To join us, Dr. Thomas Lim, podiatrist of Sunset Foot Clinic. They're moving, and that means the grandfathered revolving Happy Foot, Sad Foot sign is no more. 866-893-KPECC. Sean, in Arleta, your favorite L.A. sign.
Hey, Larry. Yeah, my favorite was down by the airport. There was a strip club with a great big sign proclaiming nude nudes.
It was live nude nudes. That's what was even funnier, right?
Even better, exactly.
Yes, live nude nudes. Of course, you'd have to have them live in a strip club, but that's another sign that made its way into multiple movies and a great source of humor. Sean, thanks. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Priya in Sherman Oaks, your favorite sign.
Hi, Larry. Big fan.
Thanks.
So I've got two. One current one is Ethical Drugs. It's in Koreatown. It's a pharmacy.
Yes.
I just love this sign.
I know. Because who would want to shop at an unethical drugstore?
Exactly. Exactly. And then another one was one that existed about like 20 years ago when I lived near like the Century City Mall. It was this electronic sign that had, it said something like number of smoking deaths each year. And then, like, the number would, like, go up every, I don't know, certain number of minutes. And every time I would see the number go up, I would get really sad and, like, start crying sometimes because I thought someone just died.
Yeah, yeah.
Really sad.
Yeah, I remember, I don't know if it was that one, but there were other signs like that to try and, you know, hit home with the impact of smoking and the number of lives lost. And yeah, there were, they got your attention, no question. Priya, thanks. 866-893-KPECC. Masuk tweets at AirTalk, I missed the old Giant Penny on Broadway, downtown LA, across the street from the $1 million Dollar Theater. Cameron in San Bernardino wondering about the huge Paul Bunyan guy with the golf club in his hands to advertise the public golf course that was there near where the Goodyear airstrip was. Yeah, I wonder what happened to that huge Paul Bunyan guy. And, you know, they were at tire stores and at a bunch of different places. They were very popular for a while. 866-893-KPECC. Francis in Pasadena, your favorite sign.
Yeah, the Western Exterminator sign that you can see from the Hollywood Freeway.
The guy holding the mallet behind his back?
Right, especially back in the day when it used to have the little rats running all around the edge of it.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, and so you'd have that neon movement to it. Western Exterminator sign, been around for years, a very famous L.A. sign. Francis, thanks. Andrew in Brentwood says the carpet store Lawrence of La Brea in Beverly Hills. Every time he drives by it, he hears the Lawrence of Arabia overture. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lisa in North Hollywood, your favorite.
My favorite sign is Carter Sexton Art Supply in Studio City. They have a giant painter's palette as their sign, and all the color, the neon colors still light up.
Ooh, wow. I'm going to have to drive by that. What street's it on in Studio City?
It's on Laurel Canyon.
Okay. I'm going to have to look for that more. Maybe I've seen it and just didn't register. Carter Sexton Artist Materials in Studio City. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Steve in Whittier, your favorite sign.
In the 60s and 70s, at the end of Fountain Avenue, where it dead-ended into below, in Sunset Strip, there was an institution called the Institute of Oral Love.
Are you serious?
No, Larry, it was there for 20 years. Apparently, the con was guys would go in, pay a lot of money, and the only service they'd get is they could talk to an unclad female.
And the institute, but it had an appealing sign, it sounds like. All right, 866-893-KPECC. Frank in Pasadena, your favorite L.A. sign.
In-N-Out Hamburger. You see that sign anywhere you go, and you know that's your neighbor, and that's Southern California.
It is completely iconic, no question, Frank. I appreciate it. Let's see, Hong in Silver Lake, your favorite sign.
Oh, hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. So when I was a kid growing up in Silver Lake, there was this old Taekwondo dojo, and there's a big, huge hand-painted sign of, like, there's one guy wearing his Taekwondo, I guess, uniform, and there's, like, another guy jump-kicking him, and I was fascinated by that as a kid. It's now the yummy.com on Sunset, but it used to be a Taekwondo dojo back in the day.
Ong, thanks very much. We appreciate it. Scott in North Hollywood wants to bring up Chicken Boy, which was on the roof of a chicken restaurant, one of those huge, like Paul Bunyan-esque ones with a chicken head. Chicken Boy is now in Highland Park, is home on a roof of a building on Figueroa in the Highland Park area where it was lovingly saved. Let's see. Western Exterminator sign getting much love. Ship sign getting a lot of love. Randy's Donuts. Nice to see that Randy's is so beloved. Rancho Super Car Wash outside Palm Springs. JJ writes on the page, its animated lights at night are absolutely super. Ian tweets at AirTalk, love the revolving House of Pies sign in Los Feliz. Let's see. Tony in Santa Barbara says you can't forget the classic copper tone girl ad on billboards, including Sunset and Hollywood. The fantastic neon sign for Good Luck Bar at Hillhurst and Sunset. JJ tweeting at AirTalk and said it was stolen off the building. That's unfortunate. All right, again, you can share your favorite L.A. signs on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Coming up next, the New Yorker TV critic Emily Nussbaum is going to be Terry's guest today. Have a wonderful afternoon. I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next AirTalk on KPECC.